Why I Write Such Excellent Books, Part 3. Beyond Good and Evil, The Prelude to a Philosophy of the Future. 1. My work for the years that followed was prescribed as distinctly as possible. Now that the yea-saying part of my life task was accomplished, there came the turn of the negative portion, both in word and deed, the transvaluation of all values that had existed hitherto, the great war, the conjuring up of the day when the fatal outcome of the struggle would be decided. Meanwhile, I had slowly to look about me for my peers, for those who, out of strength, would proffer me a helping hand in my work of destruction. From that time onward, all my writings are so much bait. Maybe I understand as much about fishing as most people. If nothing was caught, it was not I who was at fault. There were no fish to come and bite. Two. In all its essential points, this book, 1886, is a criticism of modernity. Embracing the modern sciences, arts, even politics, together with certain indications as to a type which would be the reverse of modern man, or as little like him as possible, a noble and yea-saying type. In this last respect, the book is a school for gentlemen, the term gentleman being understood here in a much more spiritual and radical sense than it has implied hitherto. All those things of which the age is proud, as, for instance, far-famed objectivity, sympathy with all that suffers, the historical sense, with its subjection to foreign tastes, with its lying in the dust before petit fait, and the rage for science are shown to be the contradiction of the type recommended and are regarded as almost ill-bred. If you remember that this book follows upon Zarathustra, you may possibly guess to what system of diet it owes its life. The eye which, owing to tremendous constraint, has become accustomed to see at a great distance. Zarathustra is even more far-sighted than the Tsar, is here forced to focus sharply that which is close at hand, the present time, the things that lie about him. In all the aphorisms, and more particularly in the form of this book, the reader will find the same voluntary turning away from those instincts which made a Zarathustra a possible feat. Refinement in form, in aspiration, and in the art of keeping silent are more or less obvious qualities. Psychology is handled with deliberate hardness and cruelty. The whole book does not contain one single good-natured word. All this sort of thing refreshes a man. Who can guess the kind of recreation that is necessary after such an expenditure of goodness as is to be found in Zarathustra? From a theological standpoint, now pay ye heed, for it is but on rare occasions that I speak as a theologian. It was God himself who, at the end of his great work, coiled himself up in the form of a serpent at the foot of the tree of knowledge. It was thus that he recovered from being a god. He had made everything too beautiful. The devil is simply God's moment of idleness on that seventh day. The Genealogy of Morals, a Polemic. The three essays which constitute this genealogy are, as regards expression, aspiration, and the art of the unexpected, perhaps the most curious things that have ever been written. Dionysus, as you know, is also the god of darkness. In each case, the beginning is calculated to mystify. It is cool, scientific, even ironical, intentionally thrust to the fore, intentionally reticent. Gradually less calmness prevails. Here and there a flash of lightning defines the horizon. Exceedingly unpleasant truths break upon your ears from out remote distances with a dull, rumbling sound, until very soon a fierce tempo is attained in which everything presses forwards at a terrible degree of tension. At the end, in each case, amid fearful thunderclaps, a new truth shines out between thick clouds. The truth of the first essay is the psychology of Christianity, the birth of Christianity out of the spirit of resentment, not, as is supposed, out of the spirit. In all its essentials, a counter-movement, the great insurrection against the dominion of noble values. The second essay contains the psychology of conscience. This is not, as you may believe, the voice of God in man. It is the instinct of cruelty, which turns it inwards once it is unable to discharge itself outwardly. Cruelty is here exposed, for the first time, as one of the oldest and most indispensable elements in the foundation of culture. The third essay replies to the question as to the origin of the formidable power of the ascetic ideal, of the priest ideal, despite the fact that this ideal is essentially detrimental, that it is a will to non-entity and to decadence. Reply: it flourished not because God was active behind the priests, as is generally believed, but because it was a faute de milieu, from the fact that hitherto it has been the only ideal and has had no competitors. For man prefers to aspire to non-entity than not to aspire at all. But above all, until the time of Zarathustra, there was no such thing as a counter-ideal. You have understood my meaning. Three decisive overtures on the part of a psychologist to a transvaluation of all values. This book contains the first psychology of the priest. The Twilight of the Idols: How to Philosophize with the Hammer. 1. This work, which covers scarcely 150 pages, with its cheerful and fateful tone, like a laughing demon, and the production of which occupied so few days that I hesitate to give their number, is altogether an exception among books. There is no work more rich in substance, more independent, more upsetting, more wicked. If anyone should desire to obtain a rapid sketch of how everything before my time was standing on its head, he should begin reading me in this book. That which is called Idols on the title page is simply the old truth that has been believed in hitherto. In plain English, The Twilight of the Idols means that the old truth is on its last legs. 2. There is no reality, no ideality, which has not been touched in this book. Touched? What a cautious euphemism! Not only the eternal idols, but also the youngest, that is to say, the most senile, modern ideas, for instance. A strong wind blows between the trees, and in all directions fall the fruit. The truths! There is a waste of an all-too-rich autumn in this book. You trip over truths. You even crush some to death. There are too many of them. Those things that you can grasp, however, are quite unquestionable. There are irrevocable decrees. I alone have the criterion of truths in my possession. I alone can decide. it would seem as if a second consciousness had grown up in me, as if the life will in me had thrown a light upon the downward path along which it has been running throughout the ages. The downward path. Hitherto, this has been called the road to truth. All obscure impulse, darkness and dismay, is at an end. The good man was precisely he who was least aware of the proper way. Translator's footnote. A witty reference to Goethe's well-known passage in the prologue to Faust. A good man, though in darkness and dismay, may still be conscious of the proper way. The words are spoken by the Lord. End translator's note. And, speaking in all earnestness, no one before me knew the proper way, the way upwards. Only after my time could men once more find hope, life tasks, and roads mapped out that lead to culture. I am the joyful harbinger of this culture. On this account alone, I am also a fatality. 3. Immediately after the completion of the above-named work, and without letting even one day go by, I tackled the formidable task of the transvaluation with a supreme feeling of pride which nothing could equal. And, certain at each moment of my immortality, I cut sign after sign upon tablets of brass with the sureness of fate. The preface came into being on the 3rd of September 1888. When, after having written it down, I went out into the open that morning, I was greeted by the most beautiful day I had ever seen in the upper Engadine. Clear, glowing with colour, and presenting all the contrasts and all the intermediary gradations between ice and the south. I left Sils Maria only on the 20th of September. I had been forced to delay my departure owing to floods, and I was very soon, and for some days, the only visitor in this wonderful spot, on which my gratitude bestows the gift of an immortal name. After a journey that was full of incidents, and not without danger to life, as for instance at Como, which was flooded when I reached it in the dead of night, I got to Turin on the afternoon of the 21st. Turin is the only suitable place for me, and it shall be my home henceforward. I took the same lodgings as I had occupied in the spring, 6111, via Carlo Alberto, opposite the mighty Palazzo Carignano, in which Vittorio Emmanuel was born, and I had a view of the Piazza Carlo Alberto, and above it across to the hills. Without hesitating or allowing myself to be disturbed for a single moment, I returned to my work, only the last quarter of which had still to be written. On the 30th of September, tremendous triumph, the seventh day, the leisure of a god on the banks of the Po. Translator's footnote. There is a wonderful promenade along the banks of the Po, for which Turin is famous, and of which Nietzsche was particularly fond. End translator's note. On the same day, I wrote the preface to The Twilight of the Idols, the correction of the proofs of which provided me with recreation during the month of September. Never in my life have I experienced such an autumn. Nor had I ever imagined that such things were possible on earth. A Claude Lorrain extended to infinity, each day equal to the last in its wild perfection. The Case of Wagner, A Musician's Problem. 1. In order to do justice to this essay, a man ought to suffer from the fate of music as from an open wound. From what do I suffer when I suffer from the fate of music? From the fact that music has lost its world-transfiguring, yea-saying character, that it is decadent music, and no longer the flute of Dionysus. Supposing, however, that the fate of music be as dear to man as his own life, because joy and suffering are alike bound up with it, then he will find this pamphlet comparatively mild and full of consideration. To be cheerful in such circumstances and laugh good-naturedly with others at oneself, ridendo dicere severum. Translator's note, the motto of the case of Wagner. End of translator's note. When the verum dicere would justify every sort of hardness, is humanity itself. Who doubts that I, old artillery man that I am, would be able, if I liked, to point my heavy guns at Wagner? Everything decisive in this question I kept to myself. I have loved Wagner. After all, an attack upon a more than usually subtle unknown person, whom another would not have divined so easily, lies in the meaning and path of my life task. Oh, I have still quite a number of other unknown persons to unmask besides a Cagliostro of music. Above all, I have to direct an attack against the German people, who, in matters of the spirit, grow every day more indolent, poorer in instincts, and more honest, who, with an appetite for which they are to be envied, continue to diet themselves on contradictions and gulp down faith in company with science. Christian love, together with anti-Semitism, and the will to power, to the empire, dished up with the gospel of the humble, without showing the slightest signs of indigestion. Fancy this absence of party feeling in the presence of opposites. Fancy this gastric neutrality and disinterestedness. Behold this sense of justice in the German palate, which can grant equal rights to all, which finds everything tasteful. Without a shadow of a doubt, the Germans are idealists. When I was last in Germany, I found a German taste striving to grant Wagner and the trumpeter of Sackingen equal rights. Translator's footnote, an opera by Nessler, which was all the rage in Germany 20 years ago. End translator's note. Well, I witnessed the attempts of the people of Leipzig to do honour to one of the most genuine and most German of musicians, using German here in the old sense of the word, a man who is no mere German of the Empire, the Master Heinrich Schulz, by founding a Liszt's society, the object of which was to cultivate and spread artful, Listige, church music. Translator's footnote. Unfortunately, it is impossible to render this play on the words in English. End translator's note. Without a shadow of doubt, the Germans are idealists. Two. But here, nothing shall stop me from being rude, and from telling the Germans one or two unpleasant home truths. Who else would do it if I did not? I refer to their laxity in matters historical. Not only have the Germans entirely lost the breadth of vision which enables one to grasp the course of culture and the values of culture, not only are they one and all political or church puppets, but they have also actually put a ban upon this very breadth of vision. A man must first and foremost be German. He must belong to the race. Then only can he pass judgment upon all values and lack of values in history. Then only can he establish them. To be German is in itself an argument. Germany, Germany above all, is a principle. Translator's note: the German national song, Deutschland, Deutschland über alles. And translator's note: the Germans stand for the moral order of the universe in history. Compared with the Roman Empire, they are the upholders of freedom. Compared with the 18th century, they are the restorers of morality, of the categorical imperative. There is such a thing as the writing of history according to the lights of Imperial Germany. There is, I fear, anti-Semitic history. There is also history written with an eye to the court, and Herr von Tretzk is not ashamed of himself. Quite recently, an idiotic opinion in Historicus, an observation of Fischer, the Swabian aesthete, since happily deceased, made the round of the German newspapers as a truth to which every German must assent. The observation was this: the Renaissance and the Reformation only together constitute a whole, the aesthetic rebirth and the moral rebirth. When I listen to such things, I lose all patience, and I feel inclined, I even feel it my duty, to tell the Germans, for once in a way, all that they have on their conscience. Every great crime against culture for the last four centuries lies on their conscience. And always for the same reason, always owing to their bottomless cowardice in the face of reality, which is also cowardice in the face of truth. Always owing to the love of falsehood, which has become almost instinctive in them, in short, idealism. It was the Germans who caused Europe to lose the fruits, the whole meaning of her last period of greatness, the period of the Renaissance. At a moment when a higher order of values, values that were noble, that said yea to life, and that guaranteed a future, had succeeded in triumphing over the opposite values, the values of degeneration, in the very seat of Christianity itself, and even in the hearts of those sitting there. Luther, that cursed monk, not only restored the church, but, what was a thousand times worse, restored Christianity, and at a time too when it lay defeated. Christianity, the denial of the will to live, exalted to a religion. Luther was an impossible monk who, thanks to his own impossibility, attacked the church, and in doing so, restored it. Catholics would be perfectly justified in celebrating feasts in honour of Luther, and in producing festival plays in his honour. Translator's note: ever since the year 1617, such plays have been produced by the Protestants of Germany. End translator's note. Luther and the rebirth of morality. May all psychology go to the devil. Without a shadow of a doubt, the Germans are idealists. On two occasions when, at the cost of enormous courage and self-control, an upright, unequivocal, and perfectly scientific attitude of mind had been attained, the Germans were able to discover backstairs leading down to the old ideal again, compromises between truth and the ideal, and, in short, formulae for the right to reject science and to perpetrate falsehoods. Leibniz and Kant. These two great breaks upon the intellectual honesty of Europe. Finally, at a moment when there appeared on the bridge that spanned two centuries of decadence, a superior force of genius and will, which was strong enough to consolidate Europe and to convert it into a political and economic unit, with the object of ruling the world, the Germans, with their wars of independence, robbed Europe of the significance, the marvellous significance of Napoleon's life, and in doing so, they laid on their conscience everything that followed, everything that exists today. This sickliness and want of reason, which is most opposed to culture, and which is called nationalism, this névrose nationale, from which Europe is suffering acutely, this eternal subdivision of Europe into petty states with politics on a municipal scale, they have robbed Europe itself of its significance, of its reason, and have stuffed it into a cul-de-sac. Is there anyone except me who knows the way out of this cul-de-sac? Does anyone except me know of an aspiration which would be great enough to bind the peoples of Europe once more together? 3. And after all, why should I not express my suspicions? In my case too, the Germans will attempt to make a great fate give birth merely to a mouse. Up to the present, they have compromised themselves with me. I doubt whether the future will improve them. Alas, how happy I should be to prove a false prophet in this matter. My natural readers and listeners are already Russians, Scandinavians, and Frenchmen. Will they always be the same? In the history of knowledge, Germans are represented only by doubtful names. They have been able to produce only unconscious swindlers. This word applies to Fichte, Schelling, Schopenhauer, Hegel, and Schleiermacher, just as well as to Kant or Leibniz. They were all merely Schleiermachers. Translator's footnote. Schleiermacher literally means a weaver or maker of veils. End translator's note. The Germans must not have the honour of seeing the first upright intellect in the history of intellects. That intellect in which truth ultimately got the better of the fraud of 4,000 years. Reckoned as one with the German intellect. German intellect is my foul air. I breathe with difficulty in the neighbourhood of this psychological uncleanliness that has now become instinctive, an uncleanliness which in every word and expression betrays a German. They have never undergone a 17th century of hard self-examination, as the French have. A La Rochefoucauld, a Descartes, are 1,000 times more upright than the very first among Germans. The latter have not yet had any psychologists. But psychology is almost the standard of measurement for the cleanliness or uncleanliness of a race. For if a man is not even clean, how can he be deep? The Germans are like women. You can scarcely ever fathom their depths. They haven't any, and that's the end of it. Thus they cannot even be called shallow. That which is called deep in Germany is precisely this instinctive uncleanliness towards oneself, of which I have just spoken. People refuse to be clear in regards to their own natures. Might I be allowed, perhaps, to suggest the word German as an international epithet denoting this psychological depravity? At the moment of writing, for instance, the German emperor is declaring it to be his Christian duty to liberate the slaves in Africa. Among us Europeans, then, this would be called simply German. Have the Germans ever produced even a book that had depth? They are lacking in the mere idea of what constitutes a book. I have known scholars who thought that Kant was deep. At the court of Prussia, I fear that Herr von Treitschke is regarded as deep. And when I happen to praise Sandel as a deep psychologist, I have often been compelled, in the company of German university professors, to spell his name aloud. 4. And why should I not proceed to the end? I am fond of clearing the air. It is even part of my ambition to be considered as essentially a despiser of Germans. I expressed my suspicions of the German character even at the age of 26. See Thoughts Out of Season, Volume 2, pages 164 to 165. To my mind, the Germans are impossible. When I try to think of the kind of man who is opposed to me in all my instincts, my mental image takes the form of a German. The first thing I ask myself when I begin analysing a man is whether he has a feeling for distance in him, whether he sees rank, gradation, and order everywhere between man and man, whether he makes distinctions. For this is what constitutes a gentleman. Otherwise, he belongs hopelessly to that open-hearted, open-minded, alas, and always very good-natured species, la canaille. But the Germans are canaille. Alas, they are so good-natured, a man lowers himself by frequenting the society of Germans. The German places everyone on an equal footing. With the exception of my intercourse with one or two artists, and above all with Richard Wagner, I cannot say that I have spent one pleasant hour with Germans. Suppose, for one moment, that the profoundest spirit of all ages were to appear among Germans, then one of the saviours of the capital would be sure to arise and declare that his own ugly soul was just as great. I can no longer abide this race, with which a man is always in bad company, which has no idea of nuances. Woe to me, I am a nuance, and which has not esprit in its feet, and cannot even walk withal. In short, the Germans have no feet at all. They simply have legs. The Germans have not the faintest idea of how vulgar they are, but this in itself is the acme of vulgarity. They are not even ashamed of being merely Germans. They will have their say in everything. They regard themselves as fit to decide all questions. I even fear they have decided about me. My whole life is essentially a proof of this remark. In vain have I sought among them for a sign of tact and delicacy towards myself. Among Jews I did indeed find it, but not among Germans. I am so constituted as to be gentle and kindly to everyone. I have the right not to draw distinctions. But this does not prevent my eyes from being open. I accept no one, and least of all my friends. I only trust that this has not prejudiced my reputation for humanity among them. There are five or six things which I have always made points of honour, albeit the truth remains that for many years I have considered almost every letter that has reached me as a piece of cynicism. There is more cynicism in an attitude of goodwill towards me than any sort of hatred. I tell every friend to his face that he has never thought it worth his while to study any one of my writings. From the slightest hints, I gather that they do not even know what lies hidden in my books. And with regard to even to my Zarathustra, which of my friends would have seen more in it than a piece of unwarrantable, though fortunately harmless, arrogance? 10 years have elapsed, and no one has yet felt it a duty to his conscience to defend my name against the absurd silence beneath which it has been entombed. It was a foreigner, a Dane, who first showed sufficient keenness of instinct and courage to do this, and who protested indignantly against my so-called friends. at what German university today would such lectures on my philosophy be possible as those which Dr. Brandes delivered last spring in Copenhagen, thus proving once more his right to the title psychologist? For my part, these things have never caused me any pain. That which is necessary does not offend me. Amor fati is the core of my nature. This, however, does not alter the fact that I love irony, and even world historic irony. And thus, about 2 years before hurling the destructive thunderbolt of the transvaluation, which will send the whole of civilization into convulsions, I sent my case of Wagner out into the world. The Germans were given the chance of blundering and immortalizing their stupidity once more on my account. And they still have just enough time to do it in. And have they fallen in with my plans? Admirably, my dear Germans. Allow me to congratulate you. End of Why I Write Such Excellent Books, Part 3.